From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haven.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside SF.
Coming up, we'll hear both sides of a debate over how we should care for people suffering from mental illness.
The people that you're talking about are adults. They're 18 years or over. And I think ultimately the decision about their life has got to be them.
Then we hear about the place where these people can get help within the criminal justice system, behavioral health court.
It was a San Francisco judge who said, I cannot keep sending these people before me back to jail.
And we'll find out the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
You want to hold one?
We're getting our hands wet today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The shooting at Seattle Pacific University marks the latest gun-related tragedy in the U.S. It follows the attacks in Isla Vista at UC Santa Barbara. The country is talking about requiring treatment for the mentally ill. Here in California, this has been an ongoing conversation ever since the creation of Laura's Law. Laura Wilcox was 19 years old when she died in 2001. She was a college sophomore on winter break, working at a health clinic in Nevada County. That's where she was shot and killed by a man with severe mental illness. The next year, California adopted Laura's Law, or AB 1421. The law allows courts to compel people who suffer from mental illness to get outpatient treatment. It was left up to the counties to figure out whether to implement the law. It's been more than a decade since it passed, and only two counties have fully adopted it. Alameda County is currently debating a version of the law, but it's been controversial. On one side, parents and relatives say they need Laura's Law to help their loved ones. On the other side are many who've dealt with mental illness themselves who say their civil liberties are at stake. KALW's Liz Mack reports.
Candy DeWitt says her son Daniel was sensitive and shy as a kid.
But he always had like this inner strength. He wasn't one of those kids you had to teach right with from wrong because he kind of knew it. That's just the way he was. And I don't know, everybody liked Daniel. There wasn't nothing not to like about him.
But at the end of high school, something shifted.
We first noticed that things were going on with Daniel at the end of senior year. You know, just all the typical signs of mental illness coming out, paranoia and some delusions and, you know, other things like that. By the end of summer, he had his first psychotic break and was hospitalized.
At the time, DeWitt and her husband had no experience with mental illness. She also says her son couldn't recognize that he was sick.
He would tell me a guy's after him is going to kill him because their delusions are real. And you can sit and say, you know, no, that's not true. Look, you can show them physically how it's not true. And they will look at you and they'll say, yes, it is true. You don't know. You don't understand.
There were times DeWitt felt she needed help. So she called the police for what's called a 5150. If you think a person suffering from mental illness might hurt themselves or other people, a 5150 allows officers to forcibly take that person to a hospital to get treated. They're kept there for up to 72 hours. DeWitt says it was always a traumatic experience.
It was horrible. And, you know, they slammed him with medications and we had no idea what was happening.
Daniel was eventually diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, but that was just the beginning of a long battle to get him help.
He came home, and from there, it just, you know, he was rehospitalized time after time after time. I mean, he would try to stay on his medication for a while. He didn't quite understand it, didn't think there was anything wrong with him. It just never lasted, and no matter what we did, we could not keep him in treatment.
DeWitt was worried about what might happen. But she could never have imagined what actually did. In 2012, Daniel was charged with murder. DeWitt couldn't talk about the details for legal reasons, so it's unclear exactly what happened. But Daniel has been in a locked psychiatric facility ever since.
To love somebody for 18 years and to see that person when they were well, when they were happy, when they were in school, when they were quote-unquote normal, get ill and then be... It feels like they're thrown away by the system.
Candy DeWitt is confident her son's fate could have been avoided, So she created the Voices of the Mothers Project. It's an advocacy group looking for a new way to help loved ones who refuse treatment. Right now, all their efforts are going to support a pilot program that would enact a version of Laura's Law in Alameda County. The program centers on what they call assisted outpatient treatment, or AOT. It would let courts compel adults like Daniel DeWitt to get long-term outpatient care, the kind of treatment that could help them fully recover. Now, not everyone agrees that AOT is really assisted treatment. Opponents say the program uses force. But Candy DeWitt says we already use force through 5150s, and she believes AOT would be a more compassionate and effective alternative.
In Alameda County, we 5150 more people per capita than any jurisdiction in the state.
That's Alex Briscoe. He runs Alameda County's Healthcare Services Agency. Back in February, the agency proposed AOT to the Board of Supervisors. Briscoe says it would only involve 5 people at first.
These are the very, very, very small number of people who are on the revolving door of EMS to psych emergency to inpatient to discharge to the park to back to EMS. I mean, these are folks who are being 5150'd and coerced into care multiple times a month.
Under Alameda County's version of Laura's Law, these people would spend 1 day a week in court, where the judge would discuss their treatment plan with mental health professionals. Under the state law, if the participants don't comply with their treatment, they could be admitted to a hospital for an evaluation. Basically, a 5150. But Briscoe says Alameda County's pilot wouldn't include that. The emphasis is less on threatening consequences and more on connecting people to resources.
Knocking on their door and saying, hey, don't you want to come into care?
And they say no.
We'll say, are you sure? How are you feeling? Is it working for you?
And for those who keep saying no,
we'll send another outreach team out with consumers who know your experience, and we'll say, hey, I've been there.
Consumers are people who use mental health services.
You don't want to go on the ambulance again, do you? You don't want to be held for 72 hours against your will again, do you? Like, there's things that work. See, it worked for me. Can I come back tomorrow and ask you again?
I know that people want to be compassionate and caring and help people, but helping people that don't want to be helped can equally be horrendous.
Sally Zinman is against the AOT pilot program and Laura's Law as a whole. For her, it's personal. One day, back in the early 70s, she woke up and no longer knew who she was.
I knew who people thought I was, but didn't accept that my name was Sally Zinman or I had gone to this college, and I did not accept that as being me. I thought everybody was lying.
She was living on the East Coast at the time, and her parents committed her to a private institution. It was more common and easier for families to do this back then.
Well, I was literally imprisoned. You know, I couldn't get out.
Zinman was in and out of institutions for years. She eventually got out and recovered on her own. But she says her experience with forced treatment wrecked her trust in the mental health system.
What I needed at the time when I broke with reality was to have control over my life and more control. And instead, what was happened was control was taken away from me. That's sort of the core of why I think outpatient commitment is wrong, is when people are disturbed and upset, they need to have some kind of involvement in their treatment, not have it taken away.
What happened to Zinman is less likely to happen today. In 1975, a Supreme Court ruling drastically limited forced psychiatric treatment, except for in extreme circumstances. And states were left to decide how to enact laws around this issue. That's what led California to Laura's Law. But for Zinman, this law is a step backwards.
It's not just about outpatient commitment. I mean, it's a much bigger fight. It's about the direction of the mental health system, and are we going to a voluntary system of comprehensive services for people? Are we going to keep doing the same old thing that is based on force?
Now, Zinman is a leading advocate for mental health consumer rights. She says what happened to Candy DeWitt's son doesn't represent the majority of people with mental illness. Most aren't perpetrators of violence. And, Zinman says, we can't use that perception to take away people's civil rights.
Vote no This is a dangerous precedent.
Other opponents of Laura's law were present at a recent Alameda County public hearing. People spoke for over 2 hours for and against the pilot program.
I can't describe to you the desperation of families like mine. The horror and helplessness.
You don't change force by calling it something else. Being court ordered is based on intimidation and threats.
One side of this debate will win and one of us will lose. But if we allow the division to continue between us, everyone is going to lose.
People on both sides of the debate agree on at least one thing. The current system isn't working. Alex Briscoe from the county's healthcare services agency, even he isn't sure the county's version of Laura's law will be successful. But he says,
I believe we have this is my own personal position, but I believe that we have a moral and ethical obligation to see, to try.
Right now, what they're trying to do is find a middle ground. When Briscoe first proposed the pilot to the Board of Supervisors in February, they sent him and the agency back to the drawing board. They asked, can you achieve the goals of Laura's law without adopting it at all? The pilot program is still on the table, but the agency will bring other ideas to the Board of Supervisors when it reconvenes later this month. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Mack.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. There's a place in the justice system that deals with the issues we just heard about. It's called Behavioral Health Court. Offenders who are mentally ill have the option to be tried for non-felony crimes through this program, which includes not only the DA and the public defender, but a whole team of social services programs who work with the person to get them back on their feet. One catch: they have to want to be in the program. San Francisco has had a behavioral health court since 2002. Lisa Lightman heads the city's collaborative court system, which oversees the behavioral court. I went by her office and she explained how behavioral health court works in the midst of the debate over involuntary treatment of mentally ill offenders.
Collaborative justice courts are courts by which community partners come together. And what makes a team on a collaborative justice court is the court, district attorney, public defender, probation, and the treatment providers.
So that's a big network of people right there.
It is a big network of people. It's an amazing commitment to do justice differently, that we feel like we need to look at the facts of the case, but we also must consider the individual and the individual's needs and the history of their involvement in the criminal justice community. Much of that involvement had to do with the fact that they had a mental illness and crimes that they were committing. I could say breaking and entering. What did that look like? During a very rainy week in San Francisco, someone fell asleep in a conference room at the Hilton. That's breaking and entering. Can't be done. Nonviolent felon. We bring them into our program. We're working with them to take their medication, to find them housing. Usually it's transitional housing. And then we work with them to find permanent housing. And, you know, they're getting stable. They have a team that cares for them. They have a judge that's engaged with the process. It's a pretty amazing program.
Okay, so let's talk about funding then. How is the mental health court funded, and this whole system really that involves so many departments?
When we started in 2003, it was a San Francisco judge who said, I cannot keep sending these people before me in my courtroom back to jail. They are mentally ill. They do not belong in jail. So she called partner agencies together, many of whom are still our partners today. We all got together and we said, what can we do differently? People were starting to use the drug court model of case conferencing and court monitoring for difficult cases that apply to mental illness or substance abuse. And we didn't have any money. And so partner agencies said, we will donate a position. and Citywide Case Management, which is our lead treatment provider even today, does use funding from Department of Public Health through the Community Behavioral Health Services. So we are piggybacking on city and county dollars. Since that initial inception, we have gotten various federal grants and some foundation dollars to bolster the program. But essentially, this is very much a partnership by which positions are donated for the program.
So we just heard a story about Laura's Law. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering where San Francisco stands in terms of involuntary medication for patients. And do you have to deal with that, those questions?
I can say personally that I am for Laura's Law. I feel like what we're doing in San Francisco isn't working. That's evident on what's happening. And you could just take a walk outside from the courthouse. But I think it's really important that we have enough treatment and service delivery to support the provision of Laura's Law.
So personally, what have you seen that makes you in favor of Laura's Law?
I see so much decompensation on the street that I feel like the individual is not in the position to say yes or no about treatment, that we have from the disability rights groups that say no one should be forced to take their medication. I'm of the personal belief that an individual may be decompensated to a degree by which they're not making an appropriate analysis of whether they should be taking the medication or not. So I would say let's get them into a position by which they are receiving medication, see how they feel, they're stabilized, and then we can raise the question of, do you want to continue taking your meds? Is life, if quality of life better as a result of taking your medication? So instead of that reaction from forced medication, let's drill that down and say, what are the questions that we need to ask? This person is not doing well. They should not be on the street. I'm quite certain that if they were actually of better sound in mind, they would decide to take their medication. They might make a choice to feel better.
Can you think of some success stories?
During our 10th anniversary, we had an individual who, a young woman who is quite a violinist. I won't mention her by name, but she's been in the press. A beautiful musician. When she was in college, she had a schizophrenic break, and she dropped out of college and wound up taking some serious drugs and was in and out of the criminal justice system, was living in the Tenderloin, was homeless. Her mother would go around the Tenderloin looking for, have you seen my daughter? Have you seen my daughter? Eventually, this woman came into behavioral health court. And she was with us for 2 years, and she's stable, has returned home, and is now working in the community.
Why do you do this work? And what is this for you personally? Why do you stay in this job?
It's rewarding. I mean, you go to any drug court graduation, juvenile drug court graduation, mental health court graduation. I'm behind the scenes. I'm getting the money. I'm making sure people are trained. I'm making sure all the programs are running smoothly, that we follow evidence-based practices. So I'm not on the front lines, but when I go to graduation, it gives me a chance to see what some of my work and what that provides and the outgrowth of some of the work that I do. So it's very rewarding in that way.
Lisa Lightman heads San Francisco's collaborative court system. We want to hear your thoughts. Do you think mentally ill offenders should be given the right to refuse treatment? Chime in on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
We just released 100,000, or transferred 100,000, and we're going to take these out to the Golden Gate and release them.
You want to hold one?
We asked you what that was and where we recorded it. To bring us the answer, we sent KALW's Jasmine Lopez out to one Bay Area highway you might not have heard of.
My name is Andrew Hewen, Public Information Officer for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Well, what we're going to do here is release 100,000 fish out of this truck here behind us into the boat that's anchored offshore, and then they're going to take them out to sea and release them on their journey to the ocean.
Got a flexible end right there. He's going to back all the way up and go right in there.
This is part of a study to see what's the best way to try to get salmon with the least amount of loss to the ocean, so they go out, swim, do their thing for 2.5 years and come back.
A little bit more.
My name is Brooke Halsey, and I'm the executive director of the Tiburon Salmon Institute. Basically, what we're doing is trying to teach children about salmon, because we live right here on a great salmon migration. And this is the Salmon Highway, where every salmon that goes up to Sacramento or San Joaquin River system goes right past us.
Hey, do we have a pipe stand?
We have the Merva W here, which is already has 100,000 fish on it from the Feather River. Those fish are individually tagged. We have a tanker truck that's pulled up from the Department of Fish and Wildlife that has another group of 100,000 fish. And those are going to be soon piped right into the hull of this boat in the special container. The two groups of fish will then be taken up to the Golden Gate Bridge and released together.
Let's put it right here.
So they got a tube, and then they got some hose, and the boat is going to pull up right to the dock here. And then they're going to open the valve, and the fish are going to come swimming against their will into the pipe and then down into the boat. So you got to be ready, because it happens really quickly. It's really important because salmon fishing generates $300 million a year in revenue to the state of California, and that's gas stations, hotels, rental cars, bait shops, things like that. So not only do we want to do this for a historical perspective, it's obviously a vital part of the California economy.
You want to hold one?
Well, we got some good guesses on this one, including from today's winner, Robert Weiner. Congratulations, Robert. That's your second audiograph win. For everyone else, don't worry. You'll have another chance to win a KALW t-shirt next week. Want a sneak peek? Here it is.
Two turbine spinning, testing. One. Check.
So if you know what that was and where we recorded it, give us a call now at 415-264-7106 and share your guess. And if you're right, you might just win a KALW t-shirt. We'll reveal the answer on next Thursday's Cross Currents. And that's all for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Leela Day, Maya DePaula Hanica, Audrey Dilling, Sandia Dirks, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Christina Loring, Julia Scott, Stephen Short, Charlotte Silver, and Todd Whitney. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff with help from Eric Wayne. Line producer was Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio. This is Mal Sharpe's Big Money in Jazz. The band is playing this Sunday afternoon at the No Name Bar in Sausalito. No need to stay up for this one. They start at 3 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.